From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! As hundreds of thousands mourn the death of Shia leader Bakr al-Hakim in Najaf, another car bomb explodes outside police headquarters in Baghdad. We talk to author Milan Rai of Voices in the Wilderness on the Iraqi Shia and the prospect of civil war. As the inquiry into David Kelly's alleged suicide continues in Britain, Government Director of Communications Alistair Campbell resigns. We'll speak with Glenn Rangwala, and we'll talk to the first homeless U.S. veteran of the invasion of Iraq.
Yes, it's been very heartbreaking because I did come home basically to nothing. I don't want anything special. I just want what I'm entitled to as being a vet. And that's home. I don't want to go into a shelter. Shelters have older men and older women. And I'm concerned about my 15-year-old daughter.
All that and more coming up. Good. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. A car bomb exploded outside the main police station in Baghdad this morning, injuring at least 15 people. The BBC reports Baghdad's police chief Hassan Ali was the likely target of the bomb. It was the first major bombing since Friday, when between 80 and 120 people were killed after a car bomb exploded outside the tomb of Ali in Najaf. Throughout the weekend, hundreds of thousands of Shiites traveled to the holy city to mourn the death of their spiritual leader, Ayatollah Mohammed Bakr al-Hakim, who died in the blast. Hakim headed the Iranian-backed Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq and had lived in exile in Iran for more than 20 years before returning after the fall of Baghdad. He was viewed as an ally by the United States. Following the bombing, one member of the Iraqi Governing Council, Mohammed Bar al-Alum, suspended his membership to protest the lack of security in Iraq. Ayatollah Hakim's brother, Abdulaziz al-Hakim, who's also on the Governing Council, said the U.S. military is at fault for failing to provide security. He said, quote, "These troops are ultimately responsible for achieving security and stability. They're ultimately responsible for the innocent blood which is being shed every day in Najaf, Baghdad, Basra, Mosul, and all over Iraq." Meanwhile, the Iraqi Governing Council yesterday appointed a 25-member cabinet to oversee foreign affairs, finance, internal security, and oil. The owners of the television network CBS, NBC, and Fox have joined efforts in a high-profile lobbying effort to persuade Congress not to overturn media ownership regulations recently approved by the Federal Communications Commission. According to the Wall Street Journal, the networks are attempting to send the message to Washington that voters don't care who owns their local television station and that voters oppose government regulation. The campaign is centered around the slogan, quote, "America says, don't get between me and my TV." The networks are running ads this week in the Washington-based papers The Hill and Roll Call, read mostly by senators, Congress members, and their staffs. During the run-up to the FCC vote, more than 2 million letters, emails, and faxes were sent to the FCC. Almost all of them oppose the weakening of the nation's media ownership regulations. USA Today is reporting the Bush administration has quietly overturned a 25-year-old ban on the sale of polluted property contaminated with PCBs. The EPA determined that the ban was, quote, "an unnecessary barrier to redevelopment and may actually delay the cleanup of contaminated properties." USA Today reports the decision is already in effect, but is yet to be made public. The EPA never allowed for public comment on the rule change. The agency said it wasn't needed because the lifting of the ban was simply a, quote, "new interpretation of existing law." Opponents of the change fear PCB-contaminated soil may now be more easily spread to other properties. Environmentalists are also criticizing the Environmental Protection Agency for quietly shifting millions of dollars from the energy conservation program called Energy Star. The underfunded program helps residents conserve energy and lessen the load on the nation's electrical grid. On Friday, the Bush administration filed paperwork urging the U.S. Supreme Court to overturn a California clean air law that attempts to cut pollution from buses, taxis, and other vehicles. The law has resulted in municipalities buying vehicles that burn natural gas and other alternative fuels. The laws have been opposed by industry groups, including the Western States Petroleum Association. New studies show that a huge percentage of cleanup and rescue workers who worked at the World Trade Center following September 11th continue to face physical and health problems. This according to officials at Mount Sinai Medical Center. Nearly half the workers report they still suffer from problems like nasal congestion, hoarseness, headaches, and throat irritation. Another 30% suffer pulmonary problems, including shortness of breath, persistent cough, and wheezing. In addition, nearly one in five of the workers have been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. The U.S. Commission on Civil Rights is asking the Justice Department to fully investigate the possible lynching of an African-American man in Florida. The commission has criticized the state of Florida for automatically treating the death of Ferraris Ray Golden as a suicide. At the time of his death in May, Golden was dating the daughter of a white police officer. The Arabic satellite television channel Al Jazeera has officially launched its English language website at the address english.aljazeera.net. During the invasion of Iraq, the network attempted to launch a scaled-down English language site, but the web page was often inaccessible due to attacks by hackers. Among the first stories on the website, Al Jazeera is reporting that nearly 40,000 of the U.S. military's active troops are not U.S. citizens. British MP George Galloway accused the U.S. of using so-called green card troops as cannon fodder. Since the invasion of Iraq began, the U.S. military has been forced to evacuate over 1,100 U.S. soldiers from Iraq after they were seriously wounded in action. Twice as many soldiers have now been injured during the occupation and invasion as during the Persian Gulf War. The Washington Post reports most injuries go unreported because the U.S. Central Command has stopped issuing press releases for incidents where no troops died. The Financial Times is reporting sabotage has nearly crippled the chance Iraq will be able to pump oil this year from the country's northern pipeline. The pipeline was bombed this weekend for the fourth time in the past month. The U.S. had originally hoped to pay for the reconstruction of Iraq using oil revenue. Now the Bush administration is expected to go back to Congress to seek more money. Congress's original allocation of $79 billion has nearly run out. The Washington Post is also reporting today the Bush administration is having great difficulty securing pledges of money from other countries to help rebuild Iraq. In some of the most fierce fighting in months in Afghanistan, two U.S. soldiers were killed Sunday during a battle with reform units of the Taliban. The New York Times reports the Taliban has been able to reform in southern and eastern Afghanistan, in part due to new volunteers from Pakistan. Negotiations are continuing between media giant Vivendi and the General Electric-owned TV network NBC over the sale of the French company's U.S. entertainment business. Vivendi owns the Hollywood movie studio Universal Pictures, as well as the USA and Sci-Fi cable networks. Israeli forces yesterday fired missiles into the Gaza Strip, killing a member of Hamas and injuring 25 other people. According to the Financial Times, Israel's now assassinated 11 Palestinian militants over the last 2 weeks in Gaza. At least three Palestinian bystanders have also been killed. Scores have been injured. Israeli Defense Minister Shaul Mofaz yesterday promised, quote, to fight to the bitter end against Hamas and threatened to launch a ground assault in Gaza. Meanwhile, The Wall Street Journal reports Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat and his prime minister Mahmoud Abbas are no longer on speaking terms. In other related news, a new Israeli government report has concluded Israel used excessive force 3 years ago when it shot dead 13 Israeli Arab citizens during the opening days of the Palestinian Intifada. The report also concluded the Israeli police attempted to cover up their activities and treated Israeli Arab citizens as, quote, their enemies. The Cleveland Plain Dealer is reporting that the head of the electronic voting company, Diebold, is also a top fundraiser for President Bush's reelection. In a recent fundraising letter, Diebold's chief executive, Walden O'Dell, said he's, quote, committed to helping Ohio deliver its electoral votes to the president next year. Diebold is one of three companies vying to run Ohio's electronic voting system in time for the 2004 election. This news on the California recall. Republican frontrunner Arnold Schwarzenegger has announced he will not take part in the first debate among leading candidates tomorrow night. Republican Congressmember Bill Janklow of South Dakota has been charged with second-degree manslaughter and faces up to 10 years in jail for his involvement in a fatal car crash. On Labor Day, the Reverend Jesse Jackson and 13 others were arrested at Yale University during a protest to show support for striking service and clerical workers at the university. And Burma's pro-democracy Nobel Peace Prize laureate Aung San Suu Kyi has reportedly begun a hunger strike to protest her detention by Burma's military rulers. She was arrested 3 months ago. Opus Defunct by jazz great Horace Silver. He's 75 years old today. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A car bomb exploded outside the main police station in Baghdad this morning, injuring at least 15 people. The BBC reports that Baghdad's police chief was likely the target. It was the first major bombing since Friday, when somewhere between 80 and 120 people were killed after a car bomb exploded outside the Tomb of Ali in Najaf. Throughout the weekend, hundreds of thousands of Shia traveled to the holy city of Najaf to mourn the death of their spiritual leader, Ayatollah Mohammed Bakr al-Hakim, who died in the blast. Al-Hakim headed the Iranian-backed Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq and had lived in exile in Iran for more than two decades before returning to Iraq after the fall of Baghdad. And now, in response, Mohammed Bar al-Lum on the Iraqi Governing Council has suspended his membership to protest the lack of security in Iraq. And Ayatollah Hakim's brother, Abdulaziz al-Hakim, who's also on the Governing Council, said the U.S. is to blame for failing to provide security. Meanwhile, the Iraqi Governing Council yesterday appointed a 25-member cabinet to oversee foreign affairs, finance, internal security, and oil. We go now to Milan Rai. He is the author of War Plan Iraq, one of the founders of Voices in the Wilderness UK. He has a new book, which will be coming out soon, called Regime Unchanged. He joins us on the phone from Hastings, England. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Milan.
Thank you.
It's good to have you with us. Well, can you talk about the significance of the killing of the Supreme Ayatollah, who was in charge of the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, Mohammed Bakr al-Hakim?
Well, I think that the assassination of the Supreme Ayatollah is going to have enormous consequences. The Ayatollah had a number of different characteristics which are incredibly important for the future of Iraq. One of them was that he was the only exile who had returned to Iraq who had a significant popular base. Obviously, he was a major leader of the Shia community, which is the majority community in Iraq, 60-65% of the population, and therefore his death is going to probably radicalize and galvanize a lot of people who had been restrained up till now. And also he represented a moderate voice insofar as the U.S. occupation was concerned, and therefore the removal of that voice will have an effect on the political balance within the Shia community. Now, it's possible, as some people are saying, that the attack on the UN building in Baghdad and the assassination of Ayatollah al-Hakim are connected and so on. I don't think that we've got any clear idea at the moment of exactly how this assassination came about or who was behind it. But I think, for me, one of the most interesting things about this, about what's happening here, is that before he returned to Iraq, the U.S. government was expressing a lot of concerns about Ayatollah al-Hakim and his Iranian connections, the fact that he's been in exile in Iran and he has a militia, or he had a militia which was under his control, the Badr Brigade, which was trained by Revolutionary Guards in Iran and so on and so forth. And so they were worried about the possible challenge to U.S. power in Iraq. And what actually happened was that Ayatollah al-Hakim was a moderating voice. He was a voice counseling caution. He actually led the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq into the U.S.-led governing structures. And so that was all kind of unexpected compared to the expectations which the U.S. government had aroused. But I think it's entirely consistent with Iran's interests in Iraq and their desire not to provoke a confrontation with the United States. One of the things that I've written about in this new book, Regime Unchanged, is about the parallels you can draw between the liberation of European countries and other countries around the world after the Second World War and what's happening in Iraq. And very briefly, what happened in many of these countries was that the liberation forces, which had been the resistance movements within France, Germany, Italy, and so on, were actually negated, neutralized, and sometimes, in the case of Greece, actually shot at by the British and U.S. supposed liberators. And very often it was the exiles who came back, sent back by Russia, very often the communist parties, who had a lot of prestige within the resistance movements. The leaders from exile came back and they cooperated with the U.S. and U.K. in taming and neutralizing the resistance movements. And in a way, the story of the Ayatollah is kind of a parallel with that process, with the twist that very few of those exile leaders in those cases of the European countries after 1945 was assassinated in this way.
We're talking to Milan Rai in Britain right now about the assassination of the Ayatollah in Iraq on Friday. What about this idea that he was viewed as an ally by the United States? And if you look at the recent spate of bombings and killings, you have the killing of Ayatollah Mohammed Bakr al-Hakim. You have the bombing of the Jordanian embassy, a close ally of the United States. You have the bombing of the United Nations, which was headed by Sergio de Mello, who was considered a favorite of UN officials by the United States. You have the killing of U.S. soldiers almost every day. Do you see a pattern here?
I think it's entirely plausible to draw a connection between all those things. It's also the case that it's a very confused and chaotic situation inside Iraq, and that there are plausible reports of foreign terrorist groups entering the country and so on. So while it's reasonable to draw a connection between all of those events. It's possible also that many of them have very diverse sources. For example, many of the attacks which have occurred on U.S. soldiers and now British soldiers also in Iraq, a lot of those seem to stem from the fact that the U.S. and U.K., well, the U.K. by association, but the U.S. soldiers have carried out a number of unprovoked killings, for example, in Fallujah at the end of April, for which there was no proper recompense at the time, no proper investigation, no proper punishment of those soldiers involved. Because soldiers are very nervous, they've been given instructions to preserve their own safety at all costs, shoot first, ask questions later, and so on. And that seems to be one of the major motives for a lot of the attacks that are going on, not necessarily all of them. So I think there are diverse sources for a number of these things. Now, as far as Ayatollah al-Hakim is concerned, it's very plausible that the attacks on him, comes from some groups connected with al-Qaeda, with people coming from extreme Sunni Muslim sects connected with Saudi Arabia's ruling Wahhabi doctrine. That's all very plausible. We'll have to see how that works out. But I think that one of the things which kind of is the flip side of all of that is that the people who really are the strongest allies of the United States in its plans for Iraq are actually many elements from the former regime. And this is something that I wrote about in War Plan Iraq, where I was warning that what the United States was actually interested in was not real regime change, but simply leadership change of Saddam Hussein in a small circle and regime stabilization. And now with the appointments that we've just heard about in terms of the governing council, I think we're seeing some further indications of that. Recently, we've heard that the U.S. is helping to recruit spies from Saddam Hussein's Mukhabarat intelligence, very feared intelligence agency within Iraq. They've been recruiting the police, they've been recruiting former soldiers, and now they've put in charge of internal security a guy from the Iraqi National Accord who used to be an Iraqi diplomat and who has favored bringing in just these kind of elements into a new Iraqi security structure. And those people are being recruited by the U.S. And if I could just mention one particular example, the governor of the province, Saladin, which Tikrit, Saddam Hussein's birthplace, is the capital of, he is a Republican Guard commander, who's General Hussein Jassem al-Jabouri. And he, on the 9th of May, he was going home and he found a whole bunch of U.S. soldiers surrounding his house. He thought they were coming to arrest him, but in fact they were coming to make him the governor. And so he told the Financial Times in June, this is weeks after the supposed de-Baathification order, that he was keeping former Baathists on the payroll, that he had dismissed, he'd stopped a election from going on, he'd appointed a former Baath Party official as a mayor. And he said, we now have a system very much like they have in the United States. Our province is like an American state. In other words, I have all the power. And that's a Republican Guard general who's been appointed by the United States.
Milan Rai, we're going to ask if you could stay on with us when we come back from our break. We'll also be joined by Glenn Rangwala, who on his website has been focusing on the lies of the Blair and Bush administration. Milan Rai, author of War Plan Iraq, his new book coming out is called Regime Unchanged. You're listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute. We'll be right back. Coastal Border Boxhead Ensemble here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Britain's inquiry into the death of leading weapons scientist Dr. David Kelly took an emotional turn today. Close relatives of Kelly described how he was anxious and upset after being caught up in the political firestorm over the government's case for an invasion of Iraq. David Kelly is the British weapons expert who allegedly committed suicide after it was revealed that he told the BBC that the government had exaggerated Iraq's arsenal. He was found dead, slumped against the bottom of a tree with four cardioelectrode pads on his chest. Yesterday, Kelly's wife took the stand and described her husband's state of mind. She said Kelly felt betrayed by his employer, the Ministry of Defense, when he heard that it was planning to name him as the source of the controversial BBC report. Meanwhile, David Kelly's daughter said her father turned pale at the mention of the name of the Prime Minister's powerful communications chief, Alistair Campbell. Campbell announced on Friday he's going to resign as Downing Street's director of communications. Campbell became the center of the Iraq dossier controversy when BBC journalist Andrew Gilligan wrote in his Mail on Sunday column that he'd taken a hand in intelligence matters. Gilligan said his source told him that a claim Iraq could launch chemical weapons within 45 minutes was inserted against the wishes of intelligence officials. He wrote, quote, "I asked him how this transformation happened. The answer was a single word, Campbell." Campbell said Friday, quote, "I'd intended to leave last summer, but as the Iraq issue developed, the prime minister asked me to stay on to oversee government communications in Iraq, and I was happy to do so." Meanwhile, British Prime Minister Tony Blair testified Thursday during the judicial inquiry that he did not exaggerate the threat Iraq posed before the invasion, and he defended how his government handled the case of David Kelly. We're on the line still with Milan Rai, author of War Plan Iraq, and also Glenn Rangwala joins us, lecturer in politics at Cambridge University in Britain, also writes a weekly column for The Independent of London. He was the researcher who discovered Britain's Iraq weapons dossier was plagiarized from an American postdoctoral thesis in California and was more than 10 years old. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Glenn Rangwala.
Good morning, Amy.
Well, can you bring us up to date on this inquiry that's getting almost no attention here in the United States, but I assume is dominating headlines right now in Britain?
Yes, that's right. It's been the top of the news for the past 3 weeks. Really, the inquiry is pursuing two different themes. One is the circumstances directly surrounding David Kelly's naming by the government as being the source who gave information to the BBC and focusing on the circumstances of the death in the immediate aftermath of that naming. And secondly, it's focusing on the veracity of the allegations that he made about the government. Now, that to me will be the more long-lasting element of this of significance, because it does disclose an enormous amount of information about what ministers were thinking, what civil servants were thinking, and what weapons experts were saying in the immediate run-up to the conflict itself. And a lot of attention has focused around the major publication that the British government put out in September last year, a year ago now, which made what it claimed was the authoritative case for Iraq having prohibited weapons and the potential to produce more prohibited weapons, and made the allegation that Iraq was a current and serious threat because of this. That was the major event, as it were, in the British government's strategy for justifying the conflict as it transpired. And was stood by the government until the conflict itself, through the conflict itself, and they still stand by that document as being accurate. Now, the claim that David Kelly made was that a lot of this information was firstly exaggerated and secondly not truly believed by some of the people within the intelligence services. And what's happened over the last 3 weeks is that a very large amount of the documentary evidence surrounding that dossier in particular and the whole flurry of communications by people in government about the production of that dossier has been released by the Hun Inquiry. So they have on their Hun Inquiry website now over 1,000 pages of of detailed documents exploring what was going on in the government at the time of the production of that dossier last year. And that reveals an enormous amount about how the government was approaching this topic. Unlike the US, in Britain, the communications between civil servants and their advisors and internal memoranda from governments don't usually see the light of day, usually for 30 to 50 years, and sometimes not even at all. We have no effective freedom of information system here in the UK. And one result of that is that people within government talk and write very openly to each other. They write very freely of their real motivations and their real strategies that they're adopting in producing information for the public. And a large amount of that now has, to their surprise, has come out and has been released. And we see inside the government a very clear strategy developing over last September, in which there's a quite concerted program to, as it were, sell a case for war from September last year. They were making the case essentially on the basis of what they acknowledged at times was flimsy evidence. There's various emails floating around the government at that time saying we don't actually have that much material on the nuclear side. How can we make this out to be as strong as possible? How can we really make this persuasive? That's one consistent word that's used in the communication surrounding the dossier. There is almost like a marketing exercise going on within government about how best to sell this idea of a threat, even in the absence of reliable information to that effect.
We're talking to Glenn Rangwala about the Hutton inquiry, the Hutton inquiry named for Judge Hutton, who's leading the inquiry. What about the effect of the relatives of David Kelly, his wife and daughter, testifying? And also the whole issue of whether, in fact, he did commit suicide, the fact that he was found with four electrodes on his chest.
No, I think that particular view that was expressed in the immediate aftermath of the death, that because he had the electrocardio pads on him, he might have been something suspicious, has been shown to be untrue. They were actually placed on him by the ambulance team that arrived at the scene, and he didn't have them at the time of death on him. So I think that suspicion has been eliminated. So I don't think there's any serious doubt that it was suicide at the time. His wife gave a very eloquent description yesterday of the condition that he'd been in over the previous days, of the pressures he was feeling from particularly his employer, the Ministry of Defence here in the UK, for whom he'd worked for a substantial part of his life and had placed an enormous amount of trust in. And then, contrary to his wishes, he was named by the Ministry of Defence as being essentially a source for Andrew Gilligan, the reporter at the BBC, who broadcast this story. And so I think he felt betrayed by his own employer. And also he sensed that he was not going to be allowed back into the field that he so prized, which was the disarmament of Iraq. He had originally been planning to go to Iraq and had been promoted by the British government to go to Iraq as a member of the Iraq Survey Group, the organisation now that's meant to be tracking down what they know about Iraq's weapons activities. And he was essentially pulled from that programme, I think, by the British government. And so he saw no point in pursuing that line. And I think that probably removed for that individual a substantial part of his enthusiasm for his work and his life generally. So I think that picture has come out quite clearly from the account of the wife, the sister and the daughters that was yesterday revealed.
Mm-hmm. Outside the inquiry, there was an alternative inquiry that was held with 1,000 people protesting Blair and calling for the government to be held account through a people's dossier on the war in Iraq.
Yes, that's right. Milan might have more to say about this than me. I think he took part himself. So if he's on the line, you may...
Milan, were you there? Milan has just dropped off the line.
Not there
we'll
now.
See if we can get him back.
Yes, indeed. So one of the features of this whole process has been that trust in the British government has reached new lows. The majority of the people, a recent poll showed upwards of 60%, believe that they'd lost trust in the government as a result of this whole Kelly saga that's going on at the moment. And that really has been a quite severe dent to the credibility of the British government. We've seen Alistair Campbell, the Director of Communications, who was behind a large part of the drawing up of the September dossier, leave office, I think.
And what does that mean, that he has now resigned? I think he said to spend more time with his family.
Sure, and he made the claim that this was something he'd long planned to do, and that's probably true, though I think clearly the Kelly saga and the dodgy dossier saga, which you referred to in your introduction to me, in which a subsequent dossier released by the British government in February was found to be plagiarised, and that was directly under his control. Those two episodes have resulted in him leaving probably sooner and certainly in a way that he would not have wanted to have left the British government. Now, talking about a director of communications may sound trivial, but he really was somebody of central significance to the government's whole approach.
His background before, he was a reporter, a tabloid reporter?
He was a tabloid reporter, and before that he used to write lewd pieces for magazines. So he comes from that sort of background of being a popular journalist. And one result of that has been that he's been marketing the government's policies in a very tabloid-style way. So he's been looking for the headlines, essentially, constantly in what he's been doing. And that was one thing that manifested itself most clearly in the approach to Iraq, where he was looking, essentially, and this is very clear from his communications at the time that have now been released, he was looking for the big headline that could come out of the claims on Iraq. And so I think that is a large part of the story of this claim that that went into the dossier last September, that Iraq could launch weapons, chemical and biological weapons, or it could have them ready for use within 45 minutes of an order being given. I think Alistair Campbell clearly realised at the time that that would be a claim that would grab the tabloid headlines, and it did. In fact, the following day, the headlines were full of this story that Saddam Hussein could annihilate us within 45 minutes. And one thing that the communications reveal is that he wanted the language on that particular claim to be strengthened. He asked for a change to a word that Iraq may be able to do this to, can be able to do this. And that was accepted in the final dossier itself. So,
Glenn Rangwala, we also have Milan Rai back on the line. You attended the People's Inquiry yesterday, this weekend, where 1,000 anti-war campaigners were protesting Prime Minister Blair. Milan?
Oh, sorry. I thought you were talking about Glenn. I wasn't at that event, I'm afraid, no.
Have you heard from, what exactly happened there?
It seems that there was a very large number of people who benefited from some very top-flight speakers, including Hans von Sponeck, the former UN humanitarian coordinator for Iraq, who, like Dennis Halliday, his predecessor as humanitarian coordinator for Iraq, have spoken out very strongly against the war and occupation.
Yes, I also, just reading here, John Pilger, Tony Benn, Jeremy Corbyn, the yes. Parliamentarian, also speaking. I wanted to also ask you both about the issue of the governing council. Where there was just a major resignation. This is the governing council that has been agreed to by the U.S. government, set up by the U.S. government in Iraq. And with the death of Ayatollah Mohammed Bakr al-Hakim, his brother, who's on the governing council, said the U.S. military was at fault. Mohammed Bar al-Alum, the member of the Iraqi Governing Council, suspended his membership, protesting lack of security in Iraq. Glenn Rangwala, can you talk about this governing council, which yesterday appointed a 25-member cabinet to oversee foreign affairs, finance, internal security, and oil?
Yes. So in the immediate aftermath of the bomb, two very senior members of the governing council voiced their strong opposition to the way in which the U.S. had coordinated security for al-Najaf and the lack of security provided by the U.S. Despite their repeated requests for increased security presence there. Probably the most senior and most respected member of the council, Mahmoud Al-Alum, who you mentioned, who was the original chair of the governing council before they agreed the system of rotating presidency, which they have at the moment, and the spokesperson for the council as a whole, suspended his membership, which was seen as a very significant thing by many Iraqis, especially Iraqi Shias, who see the only thing that the governing council has in its favour as the reputation of some of its members. Some of the people on the governing council are well respected, and Bahalum is one of them. And so if they don't have, firstly, they don't have authority themselves, they don't have the real ability to control any of the finances, the major powers, the ministries, any of the resources within Iraq. And the only thing they could have been, as it were, is a provisional set of individuals who could have taken over as a governing body on the exit of the U.S. administration. His suspension of his membership took away that aspect of it, and I think for that reason, if he does maintain his suspension, then I think that body will quickly go into a decline in public trust, even further from how it's been at the moment. Yesterday, as you mentioned, they appointed a set of interim ministers, 25 interim ministers, to take control of the 25 different ministries that Iraq has. And that was noticeable for a number of reasons. Firstly, as Milan mentioned to you, the Ministry of the Interior was awarded to Nouri al-Badran, who was until the early 1990s a senior member of the Ba'ath Party of Saddam Hussein. He only left in the early 1990s to join his brother-in-law's party, the Iraqi National Accord, on the outside of the country. And now the Iraqi National Accord is made up largely of Ba'athists, of members of the regime who have become disgruntled, and of military officers. So it's largely that sector of Iraqi society who had been, through the worst excesses of the Saddam Hussein regime, been on the inside. And they've been effectively being given the role of being the CIA's the most close companion within Iraq. They've operated very closely with the CIA over the past 9 years now. And they've been given both the Ministry of the Interior now, which is going to be responsible for the police force, but also they've been given the chair of the subcommittee that they have on security issues, so effectively the replacement of the Ministry of Defense within Iraq. So they have control now, that one group have control over the two major sectors of the security apparatus of Iraq. Now, this is from people who were, until very recently, engaged in the worst of the repression of the Saddam Hussein era. And as Milan mentioned to you a few moments ago, this really does indicate that the U.S. has realized, at least the CPA, the Coalition Provisional Authority in Iraq, have realized that the only way they're going to be able to control the country and to remove some of the level of violence that currently exists in the country is to adopt many of the tactics, not necessarily the methods, but many of the tactics that the old regime used. And I think that really does cast a very negative light on any claims that they may be making, that they fought this war in order to bring a new democratic method of government to the country, which is a complete break with how the Saddam Hussein era itself was.
Which I guess goes to the title of your new book, Milan Rai, is that right? Regime Unchanged.
Is meant to indicate what the U.S. intentions were towards Iraq in terms of maintaining the military and political structures of the Iraqi system while changing the inner circle at the very top of that system, and also to describe what happened in the first weeks of the supposed liberation when Saddam Hussein's police force was retained, when bureaucrats from Saddam Hussein's ministries were put back in charge and appointed ministers Typically, they didn't appoint the number one or number two, reappoint them, but they appointed the number three in a ministry as the new minister.
Well, Milan Rai, as we wrap up, I look forward to speaking to you soon about this forthcoming book, Regime Unchanged, and the latest news out of Baghdad, the car bomb that ripped through Baghdad's police headquarters aimed at the city's U.S.-appointed police chief has killed one Iraqi policeman and wounded 15. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, this nation's first homeless veteran of the invasion of Iraq. Stay with us. Lies, Thompson Swins here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. When Private Jessica Lynch returned from Iraq, she was welcomed by people hanging banners that said, "Welcome home, Jesse." The public hailed her as a hero. American doctors immediately extended their warm support. When Sergeant Vanessa Turner came back from Iraq, she was told by the local Veterans Affairs Hospital that she needed to wait close to 3 months to see a doctor. When she attempted to secure a veteran's loan for a house in Boston, brokers told her only option was to move to Springfield or Worcester. Sergeant Vanessa Turner was one of approximately 150,000 U.S. soldiers fighting in Baghdad. On May 18th, she collapsed due to the severe 130-degree heat. Her body was full of mosquito bites. She fell into a coma and nearly died. Turner was airlifted for treatment in Germany, was further treated in Washington, D.C. She came back to her so-called hometown in Boston and faced a new battle. Unable to receive treatment for the damaged nerves in her legs, unable to get her possessions back from the military base in Germany, she and her 15-year-old daughter are homeless. In the past week, some things have changed through political pressure from Senator Kennedy's office. Vanessa's now able to see a doctor. We talked to her last Thursday. I was speaking to her with Juan Gonzalez, also joined by Linda Boone, Executive Director of the National Coalition of Homeless Veterans. I asked Vanessa Turner if she could just describe what happened to her in Iraq.
The doctors feel that I got attacked by mosquitoes, and when I put the ointment on my skin, that it must have triggered allergic reaction to my heart. I fell into a coma, but now, as of Friday, there's a discrepancy on how many days I was in a coma. First, I was told 2 days. Now it seems that I was in a coma for 5 days. And they had taped my eyes shut. And they said, once they taped your eyes shut, you were pronounced dead. But they didn't tell my family that initially until 3 months later. But anyway, in any event, I collapsed. I couldn't breathe at all. My heart rate went down to 20. My lungs filled up with fluid. I got unconscious. They flew me to Lonsdale Medical Center where I had like 10 machines on me. I was intubated. I was breathing on a respirator. I blew up. My body was filled with poison. I blew up, ma'am. I was unrecognizable. Anyways, I went through that battle. I got stable enough for them to medevac me to Walter Reed. Once I got into Walter Reed, I was still intubated for a while, couldn't breathe, nothing like that. Then I came out of the water and all that type of stuff. I went through therapy. I was still having a hard time, even as I was bedridden in Walter Reed. I had a social worker who was supposed to do some of the legwork for me, even though I was bedridden, but she didn't. Me and my mother had to do all the legwork in Walter Reed, and we was getting very disturbed and very upset because other soldiers that were also flown from Iraq and Kuwait were getting different treatment than I was. So I felt kind of shunned at Walter Reed also. But in any event, I pulled through that, ma'am. I got a little better. And then on July 10th, I got flown back to Boston where I fought another battle. I still had excessive hair loss from the war. My right leg is 75% nerve damage. I take medicine for that, but in any event, it still hurts constantly every day. Once I got to a Veterans Administration in Boston, I told him my story. I gave him my packet, and the guy behind the desk told me that the next orientation or the next appointment for me wouldn't be until October 12th. Now, this was July 12th. I said to him, how am I going to get treatment for my leg? He told me personally, ma'am, that I would have to go every day to the emergency room to get my leg looked at until October 12th. I told him that was insane. I said I never heard of such things like that. So, any event, Senator Kerry's and Senator Kennedy's office heard about it, and one of the secretaries named Melissa somehow got the number. She called me, and I told her the story, and in 2 days, in 20 minutes, I got an appointment for the first time for August 13th. But it wasn't an appointment. It was an orientation. So mind you now, I still didn't have an appointment for this leg that was hurting bad. So once again, both Senator Kennedy and Kerry's office heard about it again, and I finally got a nerve appointment, neurology appointment for my leg on August 14th. But I had to go through all that in order for me to get an appointment for my leg, which was still, and as we speak, it's still hurting. It's 75% damage. No feeling, the nerves are crushing, everything. And it's just been a rocky road since I've been home. We mentioned the homeless situation. Right now, as I speak, I'm living in my sister's friend's one-room apartment on an air mattress on the floor. And sometimes I sleep on the couch because I let my daughter and my two nieces sleep on the air mattress. So, yes, it's been very heartbreaking because I did come home basically to nothing. I don't want anything special. I just want what I'm entitled to as being a vet, and that's home. I don't want to go into a shelter. Shelters have older men and older women, and I'm concerned about my 15-year-old daughter. I don't want to put her through another trauma, you know, so we're bouncing from couch to couch, and it's, I don't know, sometimes I want to cry, but sometimes I know I can fight that, because if I can fight the battle in Iraq and come back after being pronounced imminent death, then I'll fight this, but it's just going to be a while.
Well, we're also joined by Linda Boone, who's the executive director of the National Coalition of Homeless Veterans. They're about 23% of the homeless population in the United States is of veterans. Linda Boone, what's been happening with the Iraq veterans?
We don't really have enough data yet. It takes a long time to collect data. And we represent, the National Coalition for Homeless Veterans represents community-based organizations that provide the direct service to homeless veterans and communities throughout the nation. And we're trying to gather that data on how many of the Iraqi freedom invasion that we're starting to receive. But that's, we don't have that data yet, so we don't really have good information. It took a long time to get information about homeless veterans because they're hard to reach, and there wasn't an organized method to do that. And there is more of an organized network now than there was after the first huge wave, which are the Vietnam veterans. They still make up 47% of the homeless veteran population. So,
I mean, this is a remarkable story that Vanessa Turner is telling us. Vanessa, yes. you were put in a hospital in Germany and then the Walter Reed Hospital here in the United States. When you wanted to get your belongings that had come with you to Germany, to the hospital, they told you you would have to pay your way back to
exactly.
get them, and they would not send your belongings when you were brought there in a coma?
Yes, exactly. I had a hard time getting my belongings. I had a vehicle, a whole house full of household goods. I called one of the personnel in rear detachment, because my unit, right now, my unit is still in Iraq. So I called the person who was detachment, and he was a lieutenant. I'm not going to mention his name. He was a lieutenant. He told me that there was nobody available because my unit was in Iraq. So he told me I would have to, first of all, find somebody in Germany that I can trust to give power of attorney to get my stuff back. He said, if not, you would have to come on your own to Germany to get my stuff to check out of my unit. I'm like, I just got out the hospital. I was 2 days out the hospital from Walter Reed, and he's telling me I would have to come to Germany to get my own belongings. I said, that once again, that is absurd. I said, I never even heard of that. Soldiers every day are getting their stuff shipped from wherever they're coming from. I don't know why I was given such a hard time. I don't know why. You know, I was never, I mean, I, if you look at my records, I was an elite NCO. You know, I had troops. I was a good NCO. Never on the overweight program, always 100% in everything I did, and I can't get my stuff back. Come on now. And the main thing, the two main things that I really wanted from Iraq and Germany was, one, my medical records that I needed, and my dental records. Don't you know I still haven't received my medical records or my dental records? And I need that to further my treatment, to show them the other ailments that I have? Come on now, that's crazy.
Linda Boone, you're executive director of National Coalition of Homeless Veterans. Does racial disparity enter into how veterans are treated, Vanessa Turner being an African American?
It probably does, but we don't see any, you know, on a local basis. But that really isn't the case that we have experienced nationwide. We don't. You know, there's an overrepresentation of minority veterans in the homeless veteran population that has to do with poverty issues mainly, but we don't really see that there's any, you know, discrimination based on race nationally. We don't have, we don't really see that that's an issue. We have our board of directors has a minority affairs committee to make sure that we, you know, look at those issues, and that hasn't been an issue that, you know, that we see is happening.
And what do you attribute, then, this, on the one hand, this glorification of the role of the U.S. military personnel that we see in the media so often, but on the other hand, what appears to be considerable neglect that goes on once they're out of uniform and back in the general population?
Yeah, we agree that is the case. There is often a huge support of service members, but once they become a veteran, the nation seems to forget about them, and that's the case. It's the case on Capitol Hill, where veterans' benefits have eroded, and funding for veteran programs have eroded, particularly for homeless veteran programs. They've been significantly reduced over the last few years. So there's a, you know, that is the case. What for veterans like, you know, or military service persons like Vanessa, the situation is the Department of Defense is not very sensitive to the issue that there's an, just by military service, there's an increase of risk of homelessness among the service members once they become veterans. The Department of Defense has not stepped up to that role. They were trying to create some laws that would force them to pay attention to the issue that there's an increased risk of homelessness among veterans. For males, it's 1.3 times more likely to be homeless than a non-veteran counterpart. For females, there's a 3.6 times more likelihood of becoming homeless than non-veterans. So we're trying to get the, you know, we've had help from a congressman to introduce a bill to make some risk assessments and education mandatory for service members leaving the service. So we're trying to work on those issues, but there has been a disconnect on prevention issues around preventing homelessness among veterans. And that starts with, we think, the Department of Defense and the military, and they have not stepped up to this issue, and they deny or ignore culpability in that increased risk.
Linda Boone, Executive Director of the National Coalition of Homeless Veterans, and Sergeant Vanessa Turner, a veteran from the invasion of Iraq. On any given night, 200,000 veterans can be found without homes in the United States. That does it for today's show. If you'd like to get a video or audio copy, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. Our website is www.democracynow.org. And if you'd like to join our daily digest email list, you can go to the website, democracynow.org, and sign up there, or watch or see the show, or find out how you can bring us to your local community. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdul Qudus, Lenin Nadal, and Anagara Elizabeth Press, Pravesh Sharma. I'm Amy Goodman.